Accession number 27797, Mr. Maurice Franklin, Reel 3. Now, tell me a bit about going into action when you were at Lydd against the German bombers. What exactly would an action be? Take it from the moment you first heard that the bombers were coming, whether you'd probably hear before they arrived, I presume.
I failed to mention that we also had what was known as a predictor. This was a box which had just come out for sighting planes and for working out the trajectory of the shells that you're going to fire. And we used to pick up the planes on the projector. We would get, if we were in Lydd in Kent and there was an air raid about to take place, we would get a call on our mobile, because we had a mobile phone, one of these wind-up things from headquarters, and they used to tell us that there was fighters coming in or bombers coming in at a certain degree, and we should prepare for them. Well, immediately the warning went up, out, whatever we were doing, cooking, eating, straight onto the guns, the 10 of us, get the decided, and we wait. And if we saw a German aircraft or saw them in the distance, we'd get the predictor set on it, and we'd start firing at these planes coming in.
How did the predictor work?
Well, first of all, it would only work, it had also, just like the gun, it had two men on the predictor, two of our men had to be on the predictor. One was looking, you were looking to see if you could see the plane. If you could see a plane, you see, you used to, one would move the predictor vertically and one would move it horizontally so that we could fix this plane in the predictor. Once this predictor picked up that plane and you locked it onto that plane, it would automatically control the gun. You wouldn't need the man winding it up, because it would automatically push the gun and set it. And also, it was very clever, because, you know, if you're firing at a moving target, you've got to work out the distance it is away, the speed it's traveling in at, the speed of your shell, because it's a mathematical calculation, because you've got to fire in front of it so that it reaches it by the time the plane goes there. So you've got to work out the speed of the plane. So the predictor does all that for you, which was very good, very clever. And we would fire that way once you looked onto a plane.
You had two men on the predictor, the rest of you. Now, what was it like on the gun when you were in action?
It was bedlam, because noise is unbelievable. You're firing about 120 rounds a minute. Now, this is anti-aircraft shells. When you're on automatic, that's 120 a minute. Now, you have to feed that manually, 120 shells, and they're big shells a minute, onto this gun, you see? And it's going off, we're talking about 2 a second, virtually, when the man puts his foot on the trigger. Now, it is so fierce and so noisy that the gun gets extremely hot, you must remember. In fact, so hot sometimes that the gun barrel will start curling up in front of your eyes from the heat. It was so hot, you had to stop firing anyway and change the barrel and put a cold one in the new one in the barrel, because the barrel wouldn't be true. And it was bedlam until the number 10, who was the sergeant in charge of the gun, pulled his leg off and it stopped firing, because it was no need anymore, you see, once the plane had gone overhead. So
did you ever hit anything? I mean,
Yes, we brought a couple of planes down which we knew about.
How do you could actually see?
Oh, yes. Because there at Lydd at Kent, which is the main area where we did all that sort of thing, they were in the sea anyway. And it wasn't our business to get probably the sea rescue, if they wanted to, would go out and pick any survivors up if there was any, although I don't think there was any at all.
Yeah. Did you see them break up in the air? Or did it?
Oh, yes. Well, now we see the smoke trail straight away and come down. We knew somebody would hit them, you see. But remember, we were not the only gun.
So, I mean, you couldn't claim to have done
it. No, there were other guns firing at the same time, and you couldn't be sure it was your shell. Because in the area, there was probably 3 or 4 other guns in different parts.
Now, so how did you get on with the lads on your gun? The 10 of you, you know, sergeant in charge, visiting officer. How did you get on with the gun team? I mean,
I never had any bother in the gun team at all. This is part of the gun team. Look, see this guy here in the torn overall? He was the cook for the day. Never cooked. He's like, look at his torn apron. That'll give you something. What it was like? We were very primitive. Nobody bothered about us.
We were all friends together. Then.
Yes,
I mean, that's
because
a very
we slept in the same little hut together. You know what I mean? Everybody was together. We were all together. We were not apart in any way at all. We never had a bed. We slept on the floor. All we had was a ground sheet and one blanket.
And you were all friends?
If you're lucky, yes, yes, reasonably so, yes.
Now, what happens, what's the next thing you remember happening?
You see, happening? Tell me the Stripesdale was in charge, that was me there.
That was it. Now, when did you get your first promotion? Did you get promoted early?
Yes, I did. I got promoted to Lance Corporal and Corporal very early. I was only there a matter of a month or two, and because they needed, I took to it pretty well. Here's a little example of one of the... See, this is an idea. This will give you an idea of movement order. Now, that's a movement order that you would get till you went to move. You see that? It gives you some idea.
That's for mobile training.
Yes, yes.
That's in 1943. Yeah. Now, so you were already... Now, so what were you doing during... I mean, 1941, you promoted to a corporal, I presume.
Yes.
And what difference does that make when you are actually a corporal?
Well, the first thing it makes a difference is you get about 6 months a day extra. That's number one. And second of all, you're in charge of men then. So you've got to do as they're told. Now, look, this will give you an example. This is, I went on a detachment, they wanted to make me a sergeant, take charge of the gun.
That's much later, that's in 1944, you said.
Was that, it says 44, was it? What date was that?
43.
That's when I'm going to be made a sergeant.
But what difference, you were telling me about the difference it made when you became a corporal.
Yes.
Firstly, you're in charge of men, what else?
Yes, sir. And the moment you are promoted, they move you to another detachment.
In the same battery, though?
The same battery, yes, you get moved. Because the idea being in the army, that you're never promoted amongst people who know you, because they're too familiar with you. So you go in there as a stranger and they do as they're told because you're a stranger coming in. And then when you become a sergeant, you go to another one.
Now, how did you do when you went to another squad?
Yeah, I didn't have any trouble because it was expected. It was going on all the time, you see, and people knew that people changed round. Yeah, but that gives you an idea of when I was promoted, you see.
Now, what happens in 1941-42? You're just doing this moving. Anything in particular happening, or is it just the same all around the country?
This we were going doing it around the country until we started preparing for the invasion.
So in actual fact, you're quite right. The detachment commander's course is probably the next thing.
Yeah.
Now, that was in April 43. Mm-hmm. What do you remember of the detachment commander?
Read what it says there. That's my report.
They can't read it, you see. It's on the tape.
I went on
what
this course. I found it extremely interesting. I was taught how to use a Thompson submachine gun. I was taught how to lecture to the men, how to train them on the guns themselves to be a trainer. And that boasted, I'm going to give you the final report. It says here. Very good command, plenty of confidence, knowledge good, keen, and enjoys his drill.
So you were a success on the course. You were promoted. You were Lance Sergeant now. I presume you were promoted Sergeant.
And then I was promoted Sergeant, yes. 100% I got on the course there. You are. Anyway, that was my...
And would you move again when you became a sergeant, or would you stay with the same detachment?
No, I was with the same detachment, a full sergeant to a lance sergeant. Wasn't that different between a full sergeant and a lance sergeant? Well, a sergeant had three stripes here, and the lance sergeant had three stripes. And when I became a full sergeant, I had the three stripes, and above that was a gun.
Did you have a sergeant's mess? What was that like? What did that?
No, we never had a sergeant's mess unless we went into once every 6 months or 9 months, whenever we were brought into a camp, the artillery camp. Because, let me explain something to you. We were filthy. We'd never had a shower. Water was very scarce. We weren't in the place with running water. Just imagine 6 months, we've got no running water. If we had to shave, which we had to shave every day for the officer's inspection, if we wanted to shave, we used to run the engine of the tractor till it got warm. Then we used to get our mess tins, hold it under the tap of the radiator, draw off a bit of rusty water from the radiator into the mess tin, use it for shaving in, and when we finished, we used to pour it back in the radiator. There was never any water either. It was very difficult sometimes to get water. So we were, every 6 months, we had to come back in the camp to be re-equipped. to have a wash, to have a shower. Our uniforms were bedraggled, as you can imagine, living virtually in the field all that time. You know, you really needed new equipment. If you look at the stuff here, things are torn, even look at the clothes we were wearing, and we weren't a smart unit by any means.
So every 6 months?
About 6 to 9 months, depends on the exigencies of the service. We had to comply with services.
You were still moving all around the country?
Yes. Yes.
And were you ever attacked? You were obviously firing like a lead, you did a lot of firing.
Oh, yes, yes.
Did the Germans ever attack
you? Yes, they used to have low-level dive bombers coming in on the gun sites, shooting up the gun sites. And in one gun sight, of the 10 men, it was most terrible, one of the most terrible experiences of that particular period was the fact that 8 of the 10 were killed in that one gun sight on one attack by a low-lying aircraft.
But that wasn't yours?
Yes.
It
was me and one man were absolutely unscathed. And the other 8 were killed. Isn't that amazing?
Tell us what happened in that. What happened?
Well, it happened so quickly. You see, this Stuka dive bomber, they had Stukas, the Germans had a Stuka dive bomber. And he came in at a very low level over the sea, see? And as he came in, he opened up the machine gun and fired right across the whole of the, because we put a gun pit round it with sandbags, you see? And the gun was in the middle there, and he shot up this gun pit with all the sandbags there, and 8 people died, were dead, shot immediately. And that was the first casualty I'd ever seen, actually.
And where were you? How did you escape?
I was in Kent.
That was at Lydd, was it?
I think it was Lydd. It was somewhere in Kent, because there were country districts I'd never even heard of or knew about, really.
And what did you do? I mean, you
Well, it was a terrible situation. I had to get through and get the medical to come, and we had a medical team in HQ, and they sent the ambulances to pick them up. That's all we could do. And they had to get replacements in right away.
Were you able to help them while the medics were coming? Or?
Well, we did the best we could, because we had our own field dressings. Every soldier had his own field dressings in his pack. So every soldier was equipped with a field dressing. But they were all dead anyway. There was nothing we could do about it.
They were actually dead.
They were dead. You know? And the first thing we had to do was to get 8 men to replace them. And they brought in 8 men straight away.
Now, that must have been a terrible shock to you.
Oh, yeah. The first time I'd ever seen people killed in action. The first time is not a pleasant situation. It really isn't.
But there were men you knew.
But I'll tell you something.
Were you a sergeant then? Or
I was a sergeant then, yes.
I mean, how did you react to that?
It happened so quickly that looking back in retrospect, you don't realise what's going on, because it's bedlam going on around you. It really is bedlam. People don't realise the noise and the smell of the smoke. And
I presume you were firing at the Stuka
at the time, yeah.
As it was firing at you.
Of course, we stopped. The firing stopped immediately because the crew just collapsed, you see. And it was a terrible
thing. The damage was done by a machine gun, to the Stuka machine gun.
Yes, he came in firing the machine gun. No, it wasn't a bomb, it was a machine gun. He machine gunned the gun site, the gun pit.
And where were you standing at the time?
I was standing at the side. I was holding the lanyard with his foot.
So you just missed? They just miss you. Just
you never know where the bullets are going to fly,
did
do
you? Did it make you more nervous after that, seeing what could happen?
Can I tell you, my feeling all through the war, particularly after that experience, was I honestly never, ever expected to come out of the war alive. That's perfectly true. I never expected to see the end of the war in my lifetime, because I could see the way things were going, that my life was on a thread, and I expected to be killed anyway. But I wanted to go as long as I possibly could, and that's all there was to it. But I was fatalistic in that way, that I expected not to come out. And I can say this, that for all the people I met, or 99% of them, had the same fatalistic attitude. They never expected to come out alive after what they saw. And then, they was then preparing, by the time that they started the invasion, or thinking about the, I mean, we didn't know anything about the invasion, because they don't tell you anything about what you're going to do. We were up in Scotland, and we had orders to move the crew and all the equipment down to Southampton. That's a long ride from Scotland to Southampton driving. Remember, you have to stop, you have to get food, you have to do everything like that. And we had, I wonder if I could tell you an experience we had, you're talking about the local population, how they treated you. On one occasion, we were ordered to put up a gun sight in the corner of a field which was owned by a farmer. And we got into the field, and the farmer objected to us strongly using part of his land as an anti-aircraft battery. But we had no option because we were ordered by the War Department to go there. So he virtually tolerated us because he had no option. But in his garden, front garden, he had a well. See? And under normal circumstances, we wanted water. We had no water. So we went up there and we asked him if we could draw a bucket of water from the well. Because he was antagonistic towards us, he said, no way. We suggested that perhaps we would go and take the water anyway. It was only a bucket of water, for God's sake. But he had a shotgun. And he stood at the farmhouse door and he said to me, if you put one foot into our premises, I'm going to open fire with a shotgun. I warn you. So we had to retreat. We went back to the site and we got in touch with the officer in charge, depot, and we explained the situation. And he came down to see us and we explained the fact that the farmer would not allow us to take any water out of his well. So the officer said, leave this to me. I will get this resolved in no time at all. So the officer went together with me because I was in charge of the detachment anyway. We went up to the door of this farmhouse and the farmer met us again with his gun. And he said, I warned you once, don't step anywhere over this threshold, I'll open the gun. The officer turned to him and said, that's all right, sir. That's your prerogative. But I'm going to tell you now, under the powers given to me by the War Office, I'm giving you 12 hours to vacate your farm. We're requisitioning it on behalf of the British Army. He was immediately shocked. He said, I've been here, my father, my grandma, we've been farming this land for generations. What do you mean, you've got to get out? He said, because you are obstructing the war effort. So we're giving you up. So he pleaded to let him be there. So he said, only on the condition you allow our men to use the water from the well, otherwise you're obstructing the war effort. So he had to, because under the regulations of the War Department, they had the authority to requisition anything because of wartime. So in order for him to stay there, he had to agree. But although he allowed us to come in and draw that water, he did so with a lot of antagonism. We were glad to get away from that farmer, but it was the only case we ever had of any antagonism by the local population.
I'm glad you made that clear. That was a one-off.
That was the only time. Otherwise, cooperation as much as they possibly could.
Now, did you have any women join the team before?
Not in my unit.
Right. Now, you moved down from Scotland to Southampton. That would be 44, would it? Well, just before the invasion, or when?
This was in June, July 1944. Now, we didn't know why we were going to Southampton. Now, we came down took about 3 days, actually, driving, because we stopped and bivouacked at the side of the road with all our equipment and things. And we driving down, and we knew something was happening, because all the roads leading to Southampton was chock-a-block with military vehicles. So we knew something big was going on. And to give you an idea how difficult it was, the military police at that time, together with the local police, was directing traffic to get down to the... Before we went to Scotland, we were told to go to the Isle of Wight. And we took our guns on the boat and we went to the Isle of Wight. When we got there, we found out that we were going to be training on the beaches for a possible invasion. See? And we were going to be the anti-aircraft cover for tank landing crafts which were going to land on the other side. So on the front of the ship there was a place there for the anti-aircraft gun in case any low-flying aircraft tried to attack the boats going over. And it was a TLC, a tank landing craft, which had the flap go down, and the tanks come out, and the troops, you know what I mean, the tanks. And we were the anti-aircraft cover for it. So now, we got
whereabouts in the Isle of Wight were you doing this training?
We did it, I think, on the beaches at Ryde or Cowes, one of the two, one of those beaches.
And what do you remember of the training? Yeah. How did it work?
Well, what happened was we trained all day long, and we had a tent. We went in there, and I always said the Germans must have known we'd gone on there because they'd never had an air raid in their life, the Isle of Wight, until the night we arrived on the island and they bombed it. But that's not the point. We used to go to the Osborne House in the island. We know Osborne House in the Isle of Wight for our showers while we were training. So we used that as a sort of a base. And we used to, you know, they used to practice the tanks coming off, troops coming off, loading on, and you know, this sort of thing, for landing on the beaches.
You had your gun fixed to the front.
Yeah, they had a gun fixed to the front. So then we were told to get back to Southampton. And it was then that we decided that it must be getting pretty imminent because all these...
So when did you go to Scotland? Again, when you came from Scotland, is
that... We went first of all to the Isle of Wight.
So from Scotland...
We drove to the Isle of Wight.
Right, gotcha.
All the way down, ferries, everything. We're all laid on because everything... It's all War Department and it's all done for you, see. And...
And then you went to Southampton.
No, now, then we came back to get on the road to Southampton. Now, there was so much traffic coming to Southampton. And Southampton, the harbour at Southampton, was chock-a-block with ships. Hundreds and hundreds of different boats. I'd never seen so many ships in the harbour before in my life. And they decided, we were on this, we had our guns and all the equipment that we had there with us, and all, as well as that. And they said, right, you've got to get to this certain dock in Southampton. But we couldn't get on the road because traffic was pouring in from north, south, east and west of England. And you had to wait your turn to use the roads when there was a gap for you. And we parked at the side. We went to, that's right, we went from the Isle of Wight to just outside Brighton. That's the place they dumped us to. And we had to go from Brighton along to Southampton. And we parked all our equipment and vehicles outside a little village called Bolney, by the Bolney Crossroads. I'll never forget that. And we put our guns and all the equipment in this little forest of trees. So it was camera flights off the road. And we had to wait for permission to use the road. And we waited for 3 days and three nights. And the traffic was pouring along this road, constantly, nose to tail, for 3 days and three nights, till they gave us a gap for us to get in there. When we got to Southampton, we found out that we were going to be assigned to the American Army as anti-aircraft gunner for their tank landing craft. Why we would, I don't know, because that's the war office it is. So they loaded us on to this vessel.
So that would be an American tank landing.
It was an American one. We was on the Americans. Now, we didn't know where we were going. No, I mean, we knew we were going to be on the invasion, because they don't tell us anything, you know, they never do. And we went to... That's right. The invasion. But because there were so many boats there, they couldn't leave them in the harbour. So they had to pull away from the harbour once we were loaded on, went out to sea where we moored. And every day, the American officer in charge of the troops and the tanks and all that sort of thing that was on this vessel used to come ashore for his orders.
But this is still before D-Day?
Before the D-Day, yeah. This was in now, we're talking about June.
Very early June, then.
June the 3rd or something like that. June the 3rd, I think it was June the 3rd. Early June, June the day of the invasion. June the 5th. Anyway, apparently, we got information from the American officer, and at that time I had a cable given to me by my sister, who was getting married to a chap who was also in the British Army. He was in the Pioneer Corps, as it happened, and she wanted me to come to her wedding, and I was stuck on the ship. I'll never forget, this is a state experience. And I said to this American captain, I said, look, I said, do you think I can go ashore? And I know I can't get any leave to go to the wedding. You should forget that. No one's going to move from anywhere. So I said, well, look, do you think I could use a telephone just to phone my sister and wish her congratulations? You know what I mean? So after a lot of humming and hawing, he said, I'll tell you what, I'm going ashore, which he did every day. He was a very nice guy, this American officer. He said, you can come with me if you like. See? I'll let you make a phone call, but I want to tell you now, I should be standing at the side of you while I make this phone call to make sure you say nothing which shouldn't be said. I said, I don't mind you standing there. He goes, no, I just want to wish you... And I shall never forget the phone call I made to my sister. She was crying at the other end of the phone to say, aren't you coming to my wedding? And I'm saying, I didn't want to tell her that I'm about to go on the invasion. All I said was, no, I can't make it. Sorry, I can't get any leave. You'll have to do without me on this occasion. And she was crying at the other end of the phone because I never went to a wedding. And she still heard it against me all the years later. That's another matter. When we got to sea eventually, I found out that unlike the British Army, that went to Dunkirk, we were going to Cherbourg.
You don't mean Dunkirk, you mean Arromanches.
Arromanches, well, all them beaches along there, not Dunkirk, Arromanches, and all the other beaches, in the British section. The American section was the Omaha Beach, and that's where I was, this boat was going on Omaha Beach, which I'd never been to Omaha Beach. Remember, we'd done our practice on the lovely sandy beaches, lovely sloping beaches on the Isle of Wight. See, when we got to the beaches...
Now, hang on, what was the crossing like?
Well, first of all, the first day we were going, it was cancelled because the weather was very bad. Right. So they decided to go a day later where the weather forecast wasn't all that good and the crossing was very, very rough. In fact, several vessels with tanks on them before they got to the beach overturned because of bad weather and sunk to the bottom of the sea and they hadn't saw any action at all. That's perfectly true.
Now what was it like for you?
Our vessel got onto the beach.
No, the crossing, now what was it like for you?
Rough. Barrel. I'm a good sailor. It didn't bother me a lot, but it was rough and people did suffer with it, particularly people in the hold. I was on top.
Now what happened as you approached Omaha Beach?
There was no action for me because there was no enemy aircraft. That time the Battle of Britain and I think the American Air Force had virtually been eliminated in that respect. So we never had any attacks from any aircraft on where I was. I had the shock of my life when I got to the beach because I realised that unlike the beaches we were training on, the beaches, Omaha Beach, didn't have a lovely sloping sandy shore. We had cliffs going up like that, and the Germans were on top of the ship, and they were firing on us. Now, when we came to get off the ship, I must tell you, I am not an infantryman. I've never been trained to be an infantryman, except for the basic training. I'm an artillery man, and I was used, because we had to fire with something, so we were using the anti-aircraft gun as a field artillery piece. We were lowering the muzzle. At least we were firing shells, wherever they were going, it didn't matter, because it all helped part of it to show that we were firing at the enemy somewhere. You know what I mean?
So you were using the Bofors to fire at the top of the cliffs?
That's what I'm saying. Anywhere out there, because we couldn't see any targets where they were, but as long as we were throwing shells in that direction, that was good enough.
And could you see what effect the Bofors was having?
No, none at all. None at all. None at all. Because remember, we were not the first boat in. There were several boats who got there before us. We were in a fleet of an armada of vessels, virtually. And it was the most horrendous experience I've ever been through to get at the top of those cliffs. Because we, as I say, me and nine other of us were not...
Go back. What happens when you're on the boat, you're firing towards the cliffs?
That's right.
Now, are you under fire yourself? How much are you?
Oh yes, because they're firing at us from the cliffs above.
Now what?
They had artillery pieces, and the artillery bombardment was. I mean, you're talking about 4.5 shells they were firing. They're enormous shells. They're a tremendous thing. They're firing all that distance out, and they're very powerful shells. And they're firing all going around you. If you're lucky, you miss it.
Were there any close escapes?
Well, lots of vessels were hit. People were drowning in the water. There were so many bodies floating around the water, you lose count. And it's bedlam, because there's noise. It's a smell of battle. People don't realise. You see it on the films, but all the cordite and the explosives and the shells and the bodies, all this mixture of smells, there's a smell about war that people don't realise. It's the most terrible situation in the world. I mean, you can't eat because you're off your food anyway. You don't want to worry about food because that's the last thing on your mind. Yeah. But you couldn't eat anyway.
Now, you've talked about the shellfire. Were they not using machine guns and small arms?
Not there, because they had the big artillery shells to stop them coming on the beaches. Like, when they got further in onto the towards the cliffs, then the small arms fire came in. Now, then they were firing.
What did you do? I mean, you were on the boat.
I'll tell you what I did. I decided we're not artillery men. The artillery were falling off the ship together with the tanks. Now, I'm talking about 40-ton Sherman tanks. 40-ton. So I thought, well, if I'm going to get off this boat, I'm going to be behind one of these 40-ton armoured vehicles here. At least I've got a bit of 40-ton of armour in front of me. So as the tanks rolled off, I and my crew came off because my gun was of no use anymore.
It was fixed.
We had our rifles. And all the army equipment was fixed. It was fixed anyway. So I came off with the tanks, but I came behind the tanks.